Miss Callahan's attention was almost entirely taken up by disciplining the boys. Several lively boys were making a commotion in one corner near the computer. Miss Callahan cautioned them about making too much noise and told them to return to their desks and wait their turns. With long faces, the boys meandered across the room and slumped into their seats. A moment later, one of the boys could not resist calling out about something. Miss Callahan gave him a stern second warning. "I don't want to have to caution you again," Miss Callahan said. "If I do, you're heading for the principal's office." I had observed this class before, and now I noticed that two of the more creative male students, Robert and Sean, were not in evidence. I asked Miss Callahan if they were sick that day. "No," she explained. "Robert is too excitable for the group process. He's working on an entirely different project." She pointed him out, sitting alone on the floor, tucked out of view, banished from the team endeavor. "And where's Sean?" I inquired. "He was telling inappropriate jokes about Albert Einstein earlier in the day and distracting the entire class. So he's sitting outside working on his spelling." Ms. Callahan sighed. "Some kids just seem unable to fit into this more quiet, team-based teaching." I wish I had asked her what those jokes about Albert Einstein were, but I was too concerned about her attitude toward these boys. She clearly felt that they could not fit in and that they were unable to participate appropriately, when I knew, as she did, that these were bright boys with a lot to offer. Although I doubt that Ms. Callahan would agree, I think the prevailing method in class that day was structured around the way girl students prefer to work, and that boys were at a disadvantage. This unintentional disconnect between teachers and boys can grow more intense as boys approach adolescence. In elementary school, most teachers find it relatively easy to see their male students for what they are, little boys with weaknesses and vulnerabilities. But when a boy takes on the physical characteristics of a man, when stubble begins to appear on the upper lip and he starts to tower over the teacher, it can become very difficult for a teacher to remember that there is still a little boy inside that mature male body. All the teacher's personal feelings about men and masculinity now come into play, and he or she may be less effective at focusing on what the boy needs from that teacher to learn. The teacher may not have been taught about the boy code or the mask. He or she may not fully understand the societal pressures that make boys feel they need to act strong, tough, and aggressive, and so the teacher may be unable to see the boy's genuine vulnerability, and thus even feel intimidated or, in some cases, physically threatened by him. These attitudes toward boys as learners are not confined to teachers. Girls themselves, encouraged by the school environment itself and picking up on their teachers' attitudes, may unwittingly contribute to boys' difficulties. As one 11-year-old girl recently explained to me, "Boys mess everything up. They act goofy, and we don't want them in our groups." Obviously, boys quickly sense these anti-boy attitudes. 14-year-old Kevin explained to me how many boys at school fear getting involved. "I know that in many classes, girls are supposedly intimidated by guys, but I think the opposite is true. Girls have an easier time opening up and communicating than guys do. Many guys are afraid to speak up because they don't want to look stupid." Jacob, an eighth-grade student, now in an all-boys school, talked about the effect of not having girls in his classes. "When girls are around, you can't help acting different. The good thing here is that you can say whatever you want in class and not feel stupid. We also say exactly what we mean to each other. That's really important. It's also nice not to care about how you look at school. It's fun to see girls out of school or on the weekends, but I just don't think I would feel like myself if there were girls in school. Though younger boys may be less able to articulate the effects of girls' attitudes toward them, of course they respond to them, too. For example, Randy came into first grade as a strong reader. But when Ms. Cohen organized the class into 6 reading groups, she decided Randy wasn't quite strong enough to join the top group, consisting of 3 girls. After about 6 weeks, however, Randy had improved enough in his reading that the teacher felt he could join them. Randy was very excited. The girls were not. They did not welcome Randy. In fact, Laura, the girl acknowledged by everyone as the best reader in class and leader of the top group, was overtly hostile to Randy. If he made a mistake while reading aloud, she would stifle a giggle or roll her eyes. When it came to choosing a book for the group to read, Laura would always prevail, vetoing Randy's choice and gaining support from the other girls for her own. It was tough for Randy to deal with reading at the higher level, tougher for him to be the only boy in a group of 3 girls, even tougher to deal with Laura's derision and hostility. But I believe most of his stress could have been relieved if the teacher, Ms. Cohen, had chosen to intervene. But she too saw Randy's elevation to the top reading group as a privilege. He was taking a position that she believed was naturally occupied by girls. And, in fact, the statistics about reading and writing performance support her belief. The treatment of Randy was, in effect, very similar to the treatment a girl might get if she were to join an all-boy sports team. He was rejected and made to feel unwelcome. In my opinion, such gender-based animosity should never be tolerated. Gender stereotyping in the classroom. The gender stereotyping that leads up to the way that Randy was mistreated begins as early as kindergarten, and by the time kids reach middle school, it often becomes virtually sanctioned. Based on many of the myths about boys that we've discussed, especially the myths that there's just one way boys will behave, boys will be boys, and that boys are somehow wired to be rambunctious, socially immature misfeasers, boys are toxic, many teachers may develop rigid or misguided ideas about how to deal with the boys in their classrooms. Like anybody else in society, teachers tend to place boys in gender straitjackets and thus restrict boys when they attempt to break out of them. Consider, for example, what happened when Linda Bochan, an educational psychologist at Wichita State University, recently visited a kindergarten classroom. When a little boy dressed up as a woman, complete with necklace and handbag, the teacher angrily chided him. "Little boys shouldn't be playing with necklaces," she said, and pulled him away from the girls' area. A friend of one of my colleagues recently told me of how a budding friendship between my colleague's daughter and our mutual friend's son was almost destroyed in first grade when a teacher at their school sarcastically remarked, "Adam, it looks like your girlfriend, Sarah, wants to sit next to you." By looking at boys in a narrow way and failing to recognize the gentle, creative, empathic sides of many boys, I believe that some teachers, though they may not consciously intend it, can seriously encumber the emotional and scholastic development of boys in their classes who do not necessarily comply with society's old stereotyped gender rules about how they should behave, learn, and grow. Unwitting as it may be, many teachers strictly enforce the boy code and suppress any boys who try to buck it. In addition, many educators simply cast boys as the bad guys, pointing to our sons as the source of many of the serious problems girls have recently faced at school. And so, rather than doing what's necessary to address boys' unique behaviors, concerns, and dreams, there's actually a prevalent tendency in the educational establishment to ignore these needs. Boys are allowed, in effect, to sink or swim. When they clash with teachers, administrators, or other students, they're often seen as troublemakers or problem cases. Based on the myth of toxicity, boys at school are often perceived as little testosterone-driven monsters whose aggression must be controlled and disciplined, rather than as vulnerable little boys who must be nurtured and encouraged. This, of course, makes it hard for us to see new, helpful, creative solutions to schooling them. While it's true that some boys may raise serious safety and discipline concerns, I am convinced that most simply aren't getting the right kind or amount of attention and instruction. Consider, for instance, Julia Winslow, a teacher who has taught social studies in her town's middle school for 8 years. "When I first started teaching," she said, "I was determined to be different from the teachers I had when I was young. I wanted to really listen to kids, really respect them, not ever speak down to them or get harsh with them." The reality, Julia laments, had not matched her hopes. "There are days when I feel really pleased with what's going on in my classroom. The kids have built a castle to learn about medieval times, or we've had a really good discussion about some current event. But a lot of times, I'm just a referee or a circus trainer for 28 seals. I'm barking orders, throwing fish, handing out reprimands. No one is getting what they really need." Julia feels that boys in her classes often pay the biggest price. "I'm constantly yelling at the boys. No matter how much bluster they have, I know it hurts when I snap at them. A lot of times I'm sure there's some underlying reason for their misbehavior, but I don't have the time or energy to deal with it." "What about the girls?" I asked. "The girls tend to take care of themselves more. The boys usually need more help with the work, but I can't be 10 places at once, so I'm always just trying to get through the day by telling this one to wait, this one to be quiet, this one to quit doing such and such to that one." "It sounds like it's been somewhat tough for you," I suggested. "Well, I had one boy last year that I couldn't deal with at all. He could never keep up with the rest of the class. Every time I looked up, he was pulling some girl's hair or punching some kid. I recommended that he be put into the special ed class. After he left, I felt terrible. He wasn't one of the brightest kids, but he probably could have made it on the regular track if I just had more help or more patience or something. My decision to send him to special ed may affect him forever. I don't feel so great about it." But if Julia laments the difficulties she has in addressing the needs of some boys, some educators actually target boys as the source of all our problems and blame them for the difficulties girls are currently having. For instance, I recently received a copy of a newsletter for parents from a sophisticated co-ed middle school that ran an article entitled, "Girls Speak Out, Boys Share Star Wars." The newsletter explained that the issue would include 2 subjects because the boys and girls couldn't agree on just one. The boys wanted to focus on Star Wars, while the girls wanted to write about women's rights. Accordingly, one half of the newsletter would be about Star Wars, the other half about what it means to be young women. The girls of this school, the newsletter read, are the good part of the future. The inescapable implication, of course, was that boys are the bad part of the future, as represented by their obsession with silly movies like Star Wars. One of the articles in the section on girls was headlined, "Why It's Fantastic to Be a Female." Nothing wrong with that, if it had simply catalogued girls' positive traits. But this article stated girls' attributes in contrast to those of boys. Here they are. Females are superior at nonverbal communication. Males appear to be more active and athletic, but females are actually more active athletes. Except for muscles and skeleton, the female body is stronger than the male's in every way. And on it went. Harmless fun, you might say, but if boys were degrading girls in this way, would we be laughing? Would we ever tolerate a school newsletter that pronounced that boys are the good part of our school's future? The reality is that in our thoughtful efforts to help girls find their voice in the classroom, we've unintentionally allowed potent anti-boy sentiment to creep into our schools. As a result, many of our educational institutions have been frightfully slow to respond to the genuine emotional and academic needs of our sons. A different drummer, boys' characteristic learning styles. And if many of our schools do not embrace boys in an empathic way and inadequately address boys' unique emotional issues as students, I believe that many also fail to recognize that many boys may actually learn differently than girls do, and thus need to be taught differently, too. Research confirms these differences. For example, Richard Hawley of the University School in Cleveland has posited that there are differential tempos in learning between the genders. Former chair of the International Coalition of Boys' Schools, Hawley has cautioned his fellow educators that boys and girls learn at different paces and with different styles. Gender-based variations in tempo and pattern of learning can be identified from the pre-kindergarten through the high school years. Primary school girls generally demonstrate reading and writing proficiency earlier than boys do. Each gender-based physiological difference is accompanied by distinctive psychological and social adjustments. Boys develop language skills, large and small-scale muscle proficiencies, at a developmentally different tempo from girls. Hawley's observations are important because they suggest that if a school is to provide a successful instructional environment for boys, that school must stay in touch with the unique tempo and learning style of each boy. Teachers and administrators need to be cognizant of the developmental level of the boys at their schools, making sure that the activities selected for boys are appropriate given the level. If the tempo is off, boys can be led to academic failure and low self-esteem. The specific learning style of a boy may also require a teacher's careful attention. For instance, I've observed some boys who are so resistant to reading books in class that they'll literally toss them aside to pursue more hands-on activities. Yet some of these same boys have been appropriately motivated to read by letting them use a computer, which allows them to have fun scrolling through the pages using the keyboard or mouse. I've also seen boys who, though they were known to be lazy readers, became very active, proficient readers when given reading matter on subjects such as sports, adventure stories, murder mysteries, that actually interested them. In a fascinating study, Donald Porthoff, a professor of reading at the State University in Allendale, Michigan, recently found a correlation between boys' low reading skills and their association of reading with feminine skills. There's little question that introducing texts with boy-specific interests would help boys to develop stronger reading skills. Many classes simply aren't taught in a way that boys find captivating. As one high school teacher stressed, if boys aren't really engaged, they're discipline problems. The key is keeping them engaged. Maryland psychologist Gloria Vanderhorst explains a similar concept, stressing that schools often don't sufficiently embrace what she calls high-energy kids. According to Vanderhorst, traditionally classrooms are not organized to suit high-energy learners. In most classrooms, students are discouraged from getting out of their seats and are forced to learn by listening. This frustrates students who can learn better when they visualize concepts and physically move around. Though Vanderhorst is not referring to students of just one gender, clearly many of the squirming scholars she's talking about are boys. Some research suggests that, whereas many girls may prefer to learn by watching or listening, boys generally prefer to learn by doing, by engaging in some action-oriented task. In learning environments biased against their strengths, boys may get turned off or begin to become frustrated, attempting now to get their needs met by seeking negative attention, or we might say, through unwitting protest against this educational gender straitjacket that hems them in. This last-ditch rebellion completes the circle of failure. For now, these boys are labeled as conduct disordered or troublemakers, or diagnosed with hyperactivity. Once again, boys' needs and their protests against being negatively stereotyped are misunderstood. Sometimes the straitjacket can take the form of the school's physical surroundings. 5-year-old Eric, for example, had attended a co-ed preschool before enrolling in a progressive kindergarten. The teachers at his new school had observed Eric at his preschool and found him to be an appealing boy, willing to engage in any task set before him. But they also noticed a worryingly numb manner about him, especially when he was required to join in group activities that involved small muscle activities. He had been so uninterested in a puppet show at his preschool that he seemed entirely disengaged and almost frightened. At his new school, the teachers encouraged Eric to take part in far more active pursuits, such as working in the class garden, shoveling soil and mulch, and pushing around a junior-sized wheelbarrow. His teacher remarks that being able to move so freely and so often in the course of the school day has seemed to liberate Eric from his former still and tentative condition. As well documented as the characteristics of boys' learning styles may be, many educators seem not to take them into account in their attitudes toward boys in the classroom. This was impressed upon me when I conducted my seminar on Understanding Boys at a well-respected graduate school of education. I asked the group of master public school teachers to describe boys' learning styles to me. I implored them to put aside political correctness, external expectations, and worries about gender equity, and to speak only from their hearts and their educational experience in talking about boys in the classroom. Here are some of the comments they made. Younger boys are more literal and concrete than girls. Younger boys engage in more open rebellion than girls. Boys are often poor auditory listening learners, and better kinesthetic, action-oriented ones. Boys engage in much more physical stimulation for persuasion, may get into open conflicts, and tend to punch their way out. Boys may show their affection through action or bumping into you. In order to assimilate new ideas, boys may need the freedom to play them out with games and self-imposed rules. Boys put forward a storm of intellectual bravado behind which they seem very unsure, but need the bluster to prove their points. What I find interesting about these comments is that they were quite perceptive and accurate. These teachers had a pretty clear picture of boys. But it's how they talked about the differences as positives or negatives that made all the difference. When considered with empathy, these characteristics can be seen as the positive attributes of boys. If described less lovingly and with less empathy, however, they might sound rather like this: learning difficulties, conduct disturbance, physical aggressiveness, inattention syndrome and hyperactivity, perhaps even the code words attention deficit disorder. What I find tragic is that by failing to understand and appreciate each boy's unique tempo and characteristic learning style in an empathic way, we make it hard for him to feel confident about himself and flourish as a student. Moreover, when he subsequently withdraws from classroom activities or begins to rebel or act out, we often deal him a second blow by interpreting his natural response as the sign of a learning disability, or so-called hyperactivity, when in reality it's shame, boredom, or restlessness. Fortunately, some educators get it. Some educators understand that boys may learn differently than girls, and that if boys' unique needs are properly addressed, boys will be able to catch up in areas like reading and writing, and rediscover their confidence as learners. Lest we doubt this, here's a story from a school in England where two teachers recently got together and changed things for boys. Dead Poet Society, Turning Things Around for Boys. People think that boys like you won't be able to understand writers such as the Romantic poets. Well, you're going to prove them wrong. Do you understand? Mr. Jeckles, a teacher at King's School in Winchester, England, addresses a classroom full of boys. Just 2 years earlier, the head teacher at the school, Ray Bradbury, had analyzed the results of his students' scores on the GCSE, a standardized test that rates students from A to F in various subject matters. 78% of girls at the school gained 5 or more A through C, but the boys trailed behind with only 56%. Boys scored particularly poorly in English. In that subject, 27% fewer boys than girls gained grades A through C. Mr. Bradbury was unhappy about the enormous disparity between girls' and boys' academic performance. While he understood that some boys were doing well, he realized, as we've discussed above, that the largest portion of the kids at the bottom of the class were boys. And he decided to do something about it. Since he recognized that some boys were already doing relatively well, he decided against segregating these boys from girls at the same academic level. But he decided to place the boys who were doing significantly less well in an all-boys class of their own. The most vital ingredient in the scheme's success was finding the right teacher for this group, says Bradbury. So I chose Rob Jeckles, who is involved with sport and someone to whom the boys relate very easily. We consciously planned the teaching methodology, The class is didactic and teacher-fronted. It involves sharp questions and answers, and constantly checking understanding. Discipline is clear-cut. If homework isn't presented, it is completed in a detention. There is no discussion. While some of the boys and their parents resisted the approach at first, Mr. Jekyll seemed to know that speaking the truth would disarm them. I presented the boys with the statistical evidence, which showed they were in danger of underachieving, and made clear what I expected of them. When they saw themselves as being part of a pilot scheme which was meeting their educational needs, their attitudes changed and their motivation doubled. Also, the head has dropped in on the group frequently, sometimes with visiting advisors. Now the boys have a sense of pride. They feel they are special. Mr. Jekylls quickly developed a keen understanding of why his all-boys class was working well. In a single-sex class, you can create a team atmosphere where the boys support one another. But when girls are present, boys are loath to express opinions for fear of appearing sissy. Their instinct is to stay aloof and macho. If it's all boys together, then it's much easier to break down inhibitions. Also, I can choose course material that appeals to boys. Members of my group are football mad. In the mixed groups, they would be turned off by Jane Eyre, whereas I can pick texts such as Silas Marner and the war poets, which they feel are more relevant to them. One of the boys in his class seems to agree. I like English now, the boy explains, because there is less pressure in the classroom. Previously, if you made a comment, the other boys would make fun of you just to make you look silly in front of the girls. Now we support each other. We are all working hard to show that we can be just as successful as the other groups. According to the school, after just 2 years, Mr. Jekyll's all-boys approach already seems to be successful. Among those boys at the same academic level last year, only 7 out of 25 gained a C or better in English literature. Yet, based on recent mock examinations, Mr. Jekylls believes 25 of the 34 in his all-boys group will gain a C grade or better. Perhaps even more impressive, while 2 years ago the school had had a 22% disparity between boys and girls gaining 5 or more A through C grades, last year there was just a 1% difference. Colleagues of Mr. Jekyll's are so encouraged by these results that apparently similar all-boys classes are now being set up for mathematics and science. Finding the right fit for boys. How to guyify a school. Indeed, boys will thrive at school if there is a pervasive sense that they are welcome, that they are liked, and that who they really are and how they really enjoy learning will be embraced in a genuine way by their teachers. In the National Longitudinal Study on Adolescent Health, Protecting Adolescents from Harm, 1997, researchers demonstrated that the largest major factor protecting young people from emotional distress, drug abuse, and violence, other than the closeness they were able to achieve within their families, was perceived school connectedness. The more a boy feels warmly toward his school, connected, understood, and treated fairly, the less likely he is to become suicidal, abuse drugs and alcohol, become addicted to nicotine, or engage in impulsive sexual activities. A boy does best when he feels cared for and understood by his teachers, and when he senses that they have high hopes for him academically. By designing an inviting educational experience for boys, schools can help them boost not only their academic performance and self-esteem, but also their hopefulness about the opportunities ahead of them. Just as we've implemented specific measures to help girls benefit maximally from their school experiences, there's a lot we can do to create school connectedness and help boys succeed at school. Most critically, I believe we must make absolutely sure that for every boy there is a good fit between what makes him thrive as an individual and what his school actually provides for him. For instance, if a boy learns best by reading quietly by himself for a certain length of time, say half an hour, and then taking breaks in which he engages in vigorous physical activity, such as running or playing a sport, ideally his school will not require him to attend 4 hours of classes in which he is given no time to read by himself and no time for motor activities. If another boy learns best by working in small groups in which the students teach one another through shared lessons and activities, and where no one student is ever put on the spot to come up with the right answers, ideally the boy is not placed in classrooms with huge numbers of students and then grilled by a teacher using the Socratic method. So many of us have memories of teachers or classroom experiences that left us feeling understimulated or shortchanged. When I asked Barry Rosenman, 35, about his elementary educational experience, he immediately recalled Mrs. Remedy, his first-grade teacher. "Mrs. Remedy hated me," Barry exclaimed, "and I hated her." I asked him why. "I grew up in a supportive environment," Barry continued. "My mother stayed at home full time, and she was devoted to all three of us kids. On nice days, she encouraged me and my brother and sister to play energetic games outside or go explore the brook near our house for tadpoles. When I came home covered in mud, my mother shook her head a little, but she wasn't disapproving. She wanted me to be adventurous. On rainy days, she'd set up her college microscope in the kitchen so we could discover what salt and sugar and pond water looked like. She had a recipe for cookies where you could make a figure and fill it in with candy that melted in the oven to look like stained glass. By the time I started going to school all day for first grade, I was used to trying things out, running around whenever I needed to, and everything being hands-on. That definitely wasn't Mrs. Remedy's style," Barry continued. "I guess it couldn't be with 25 or 30 first graders. She had us sitting quietly in rows, filling out those dittos they used to have before Xerox machines came in. I'd finish a ditto in 10 seconds, then be expected to sit there in silence, for it seemed like hours. I was bored to death." Barry rebelled. "I'd make little squeaking sounds while the other kids were finishing their dittos, getting louder and louder until she heard me. I'd throw paper airplanes. I'd fidget. One time she left the room for a minute, and when she came back, she found me standing on top of my desk and screaming as loud as I could. That didn't go over real well." In November, Barry's parents had him switched into a different first-grade classroom. "My parents thought I was a bit mischievous, but they knew the problem wasn't just me. My new teacher gave me more challenging work, and I settled down a lot more after that." As Barry's recollections demonstrate, there are ways in which schools can either respond or fail to respond to a boy's specific needs. Barry needed to be creatively challenged, to engage in action-oriented tasks, to experience a continuation of the stimulating educational environment his mother had created for him at home. Thrust, instead, into a first-grade classroom that left him feeling bored and restless, Barry acted out. He was lucky that, instead of being placed in a special education class as a disturbed child or being misdiagnosed as hyperactive, he found his way into another classroom with a teacher who was better attuned to what he needed most to succeed, creative, high-energy, hands-on learning activities. Listen to my interview in a similar vein with two concerned parents who struggled with the educational environment in which their son was initially placed. After explaining to me that they had tried to raise their son and daughter without abiding by the narrow gender roles imposed on them as children, Regina and Donald Lincoln acknowledged that they had communicated distinct expectations to each child. Without being conscious of it, I know I've been more protective toward my daughter, and I've encouraged my son's independence more, Regina Lincoln admitted. Both of my children are bright and creative, but Corey is much more quirky and exploratory. Marissa is much more diligent and deliberate. The Lincolns found that their son's learning style did not fit well with the neighborhood's public school. No matter what the assignment was, Corey wanted to change it or abandon it altogether. While Marissa was enjoying filling out endless worksheets, Corey was bored to tears. When his teacher started complaining about his wildness in class, we quickly figured out he just couldn't stand the tedium. The Lincolns transferred Corey, who is now 11, to an arts-centered experimental school. "I like school much better now," Corey told me. "We get to make spaceships out of clay and play drums and play around a lot more." While his new school has the same amount of recess each day, Corey experiences the curriculum as a medium for self-expression. The Lincolns are pleased with their decision. I question whether the structure of Marissa's school is ideal for her, but in Corey's case, it was imperative that we get him out of there if we wanted him to flourish. Boys, just like girls, do best in schools that give them the chance to participate in learning activities that correspond to their personal interests and competencies, enabling them to sound their authentic voices and thrive as individuals. It's important that boys feel at home in the school environment and that they find the teacher and the activities he or she organizes sufficiently appealing. Indeed, the studies on self-esteem by Professor William Perkey also demonstrated that when classrooms are specifically made to be inviting for boys, their problems of lower self-esteem were significantly abated. Who's got the problem paying attention, the boys or us? When schools fail to attune themselves to boys' unique ways of learning and don't truly address our sons' needs, the consequences can be devastating. In some schools, a boy with ordinary exuberance may be punished by being placed in classes intended for learning disabled children or sent regularly to a detention room where he sits unattended for several periods, losing valuable classroom time. For this unlucky boy, this may mark the beginning of a life relegated to second-class economic and intellectual citizenship, invite dangerously diminished self-esteem, and significantly increase the likelihood that he'll later be misdiagnosed with attention deficit disorder or some other psychiatric disturbance. Even for boys who escape these more dire fates, being at the wrong school can mean 12 years of feeling like a square peg in a round hole, of squirming with excess energy that is suppressed rather than harnessed, and of doing worse academically and emotionally than they would in schools that meet their individual needs and abilities. Gabriel. When an active boy is diagnosed as hyperactive. Gabriel Bauer Brown was in the third grade when his teacher first labeled him with Attention Deficit Disorder, or ADD. She told us he spoke out of turn, got too rough on the playground, and disrupted class, his dad, Perry, remembers. She said he could never focus on his work, so it must be ADD. At her suggestion, the Bauer Browns sought help from their pediatrician, who immediately prescribed Ritalin. Perry was nervous about the drug. I didn't like the idea, but if it worked, it would be worth it. If my kid needed Ritalin to be able to do all right in school, then that was just what we would have to do. On Ritalin, Gabriel changed. Instead of acting out, he became sullen and unresponsive. It was as if the Ritalin had carried him away to some other planet, Perry says. He wasn't making a lot of noise in class, but he wasn't concentrating on his schoolwork any better either. And at home, he was spacey and much less communicative than he used to be. The Bauer Browns decided to take Gabriel off Ritalin and pursue professional counseling for him. At first, Gabriel saw a school social worker. Then, after several months, the Bauer Browns met with a therapist who specialized in child psychology. What the therapist told us felt shocking at first, but later we had to admit we had suspected it all along, Perry told me. We adopted Gabriel when he was almost a year old. We got him from an orphanage in Brazil, where we knew conditions were pretty awful. The therapist said she believed Gabriel had been seriously neglected there. She said we had done the right thing about taking him off Ritalin, and that therapy could help him express his pain in more constructive ways than those outbursts he used to have. Progress has been gradual but continual, Perry now says. He has a really strong bond with his therapist, and he's becoming more and more secure and confident. His teacher was right that he needed help, but Ritalin wasn't it. For most any psychologist who works with boys or men, Gabriel's story is painfully familiar. In the United States, boys are up to 10 times more likely than girls to be diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, a severe enough disturbance to require extensive counseling and potent medications. Of the more than 1 million children taking Ritalin, a powerful stimulant medication for ADD, 3/4 of them are boys. According to a recent study, 3 times more boys than girls are enrolled in special education programs, with close to 70% of all high school special classes populated by boys. Many of the boys sent to these special classes and programs are boys diagnosed with ADD. As a clinical psychologist who has seen the severe damage done in missing a legitimate case of ADD in childhood, and the miraculous effects of appropriate treatments, psychological and medical, in both children and adults, naturally I would urge against a simple-minded attack on the legitimacy of ADD or its necessary treatment. Even the great gender disparity, almost 10 males to every female, is not without sophisticated biological underpinnings. However, one cannot help being concerned by the sheer number of diagnosed cases, the frequency of diagnoses initiated by overwhelmed classroom teachers and children's guidance counselors, and the possibility that many mild to moderate cases of ADD are a normal variant of boys' temperament that could be corrected by a properly trained, attentive adult. Many of these cases probably wouldn't even come about in a classroom that was thoughtfully designed for typical boys' temperaments, one that kept them motivated and energized with a variety of interesting learning activities, and paced these activities according to their unique learning tempos. One in which the teacher understood that so much of boys' outward agitation and rowdiness is often just masked emotional pain. Indeed, I believe that much of the behavior we label as attention deficit disorder is actually just the externalization through action of boyhood emotions. After all, action is often boys' only way of saying, "Look at me, give me love and attention," or "Please, I need your help." When boys act out, I believe that, more often than not, they're looking for understanding and empathy rather than diagnosis and medication. They are telling us, in essence, "I feel too ashamed to talk to you directly about what's going wrong, so I am going to use my behavior to let you know indirectly." The official name for the disorder with which so many boys are diagnosed is actually Attention Deficit and Hyperactivity Disorder, or ADHD, ADD for short. And it includes several scientific categories of subclassification necessary for a diagnosis. But the behaviors to be identified are so close on the continuum to those often manifested by emotionally healthy boys that the capacity to distinguish serious learning disabilities from a boy's ordinary boisterousness is difficult at best, even for a trained professional. In theory, the typical ADHD boy will have problems sustaining attention or concentrating, sitting still in class, or waiting his turn. He may yell out impulsively, talk too much, act disorganized or distracted, be forgetful. He may wriggle in his seat or abandon it for almost incessant movement, and the interruption of others may be common. I think you can begin to see how the line between pathological hyperactivity and a boy's normal rough play is often hard to ascertain. The decision about how to diagnose him and how to solve the behavior problems he's exhibiting is influenced by the school he attends, the attitude of his teacher, the ethos of his classroom, and the perspective of his parents. For example, a school that has a more tolerant and less rigid milieu that harnesses extra energy may be much less likely to tag Johnny with a diagnosis than an overcrowded class with strict sit-in-your-seat rules and negative attitudes toward boys' rambunctiousness. These factors may make all the difference in the world, not only in whether he is seen as dysfunctional or normal, but also, even if he is appropriately diagnosed with a mild to moderate form of hyperactivity or learning disability, in whether his situation will be redressed appropriately. Will he be treated with pills and pushed into a special classroom? Or will his caregivers try creative, non-pharmacological interventions, such as placing him in an open classroom in which he can participate in hands-on activities, or establishing a regimen of counseling sessions on a regular basis? Depending on how he is treated for ADD, the boy could end up either suffering years of psychological problems, or, if the approach is a healthy one, enjoying a life full of creative energy and success. Marty Walt, Iconoclastic or Dysfunctional Learner. Marty Walt had been tagged with the ADD label when he was a teenager. His mom, Beth, did not believe her son had ADD, but had to fight the educational establishment to have Marty treated as a normal boy. Marty was the kind of boy who typically ends up with the disabled label. He talked incessantly in preschool. In elementary school, he followed kids around, acted rowdily, and incited classmates to act up. Teachers and school authorities told Beth that her son was sick and in need of medication, such as Ritalin. Beth resisted the diagnosis and the treatment. She volunteered to be in the classroom to help calm Marty down. She had him transferred to more creative educational settings with more flexible teachers. She found a sympathetic guidance counselor who was willing to talk with and listen to her son. She fought so that Marty could maintain his own eccentric form of boyishness without being branded as disabled. To Marty, having the sympathetic ear of supportive adults made all the difference in the world. Of one of his guidance counselors, he said, "She heard me. I like it when somebody is listening. Who doesn't?" Marty's story turned out a success. He's about to graduate from high school, hoping to head for college. He gets good grades, works part-time, and has begun writing plays as a hobby. Plays about adults who can't listen to kids. No one, not even his mother, denies that his behavior was extreme at times. A diagnosis of ADD and medication might have been justified. Indeed, many boys who are labeled as having ADD are less disruptive than Marty. Although Marty wasn't one of them, 5.4 million U.S. children were classified as disabled in 1995. ADD was the fastest-growing category, its ranks having doubled from 1990 to 1995. And remember that more than 9 out of 10 children diagnosed with ADD are boys. I believe it's important that we as parents make sure our boys are not branded as abnormal and slapped with the ADD label before we're absolutely sure it's the case. As psychologist Diane McGinnis at the University of South Florida warns, many school systems to a large extent have pathologized what is simply normal for boys. Though ADD is a genuine neurobehavioral disorder, and research shows that it does occur in boys more often than in girls, I believe society's response to this boyhood quandary has actually exacerbated the problem. In some cases, we've misdiagnosed boys as being hyperactive who are simply very active. In other cases, where there is a pathology that looks like ADD, the boy is actually exhibiting the symptoms of depression. Some boys, properly diagnosed as ADD cases, are over-medicated. Other boys, who clearly are ADD cases, are branded as troublemakers and receive punishment rather than treatment. Both the sheer numbers of boys identified with hyperactivity and the distinctly unempathic ways many of these boys are responded to must give us pause to rethink the ADD dilemma. Although genuine hyperactivity exists and deserves our every effort at a non-stigmatizing treatment, one can justifiably suspect that much of what is called ADD is closer to MDD, male deficit disorder, with the deficiency lying not in our sons, but within society's inability to correctly perceive boys' inner needs, yearnings, and pain. We tend to label and treat rather than listen. Indeed, it is quite possible that the upsurge in hyperactive behavior in boys, especially younger boys in the early elementary grades, is a symptom of the trauma of separation we have spoken of, and a protest against being fitted for the emotionally limiting gender straitjacket that awaits them. As we create more classroom and learning environments in sync with boys' academic tempos that allow boys' genuine voices to emerge, we may expect to see fewer cases of pseudo-hyperactivity, better interventions when the disorder is really present, and greater success in attending to our sons' struggles for recognition, love, and achievement. Lessons from single-sex schools. As we try to guyify our co-ed schools and make them a better fit for boys, it's helpful to look to what all boys' schools do in order to succeed with boys. I know that most boys will not attend an all-boys school, nor do I advocate that they should. But having had the opportunity to consult to a large cross-section of single-sex day schools for boys throughout the United States, I have found that many of them, because they're specifically geared for boys, do a good job of creating an educational environment in which boys can triumph academically and emotionally. I have worked with many of these schools to help them develop an intramural culture that is empathic to boys, one that is sensitive to how the shame-based hardening process comes about, and how boys use a mask to conceal inner struggles and uncertainties. Many of these schools have become comfortable learning spheres for the rough-and-tumble world of boys, and some have thoughtfully addressed gender stereotyping in terms of how it restricts boys emotionally, academically, and professionally. Contrary to the myth that all boys' schools are dangerous, toxic breeding grounds of misogyny and aggression, I have found that many of them cultivate boys who have positive attitudes toward girls and women, and who may feel as at ease being gentle and sensitive as they do gearing up for a rugby match. For almost a decade, psychologists and educators have recommended all girls' schools as institutions that help shelter girls from the uninviting atmosphere of coeducational schools, where they must compete with boys and overcome anti-girl bias. Girls' schools have been widely reported as bolstering girls' academic achievement, empowering them to feel more confident about who they are and what they're capable of. The time has come, I believe, to look at whether the same is true for boys, and if so, to see what can be learned from these schools and apply it as best as possible within coeducational environments. Though we've grown comfortable with and thrown our support toward all-girls schools, all my research suggests that, in America at least, we have not yet accepted a similar approach for boys. For instance, we look askance at all-boy remediation environments for students with legitimate learning disabilities and diminished self-esteem, and even challenge traditional all-boy social organizations, such as the Boy Scouts. And regrettably, the federal courts have rejected well-intentioned efforts to develop special all-boy academies to help young African-American boys improve their English language skills, viewing these separate but equal arrangements as patently unconstitutional. There is almost a sense that while we plan Take Our Daughters to Work Day and support women's colleges and affinity groups, we are taking our boys to the psychiatrist, forcibly integrating them into coeducational environments focused on meeting girls' needs, and denying them any all-male bonding environments short of the bench outside the principal's office or the defendant's seat in front of the arraignment judge on the way to jail. I wonder what has gotten in our way of examining the alternative of the all-boys schools for our sons, or of applying the lessons of all-boys schools to make our co-ed institutions more hospitable to boys. Fortunately, recent research suggests that some boys' schools may provide just this kind of protective environment. In 1997, Diane Hulse, head of the middle school at Collegiate School in New York City, completed comparative research on boys in the 5th through 8th grades at two premier independent schools, one coeducational, the other just for boys. Utilizing a broad array of empirical testing measures, Hulse showed that boys in the all-boys school seemed less defensive and less susceptible to peer pressure, more comfortable with their aggression as well as their relationships with girls, and more egalitarian in their attitudes about male and female roles than their counterparts in the coeducational institution. These findings, in my view, imply several things. First, much as Richard Hawley would probably argue, students at an all-boys school are likely taught in a manner that recognizes and encourages their unique learning styles and tempos. Such schools are more flexible and less defensive in attitude in comparison to institutions that seek to fit boys into a rigid traditional coeducational curriculum that ignores individual learning styles and paces. Even more important, I believe, these findings suggest that at a well-run boys' school, a peer culture evolves in which boys feel more comfortable about themselves, are more confident about their abilities, and therefore do better in their classwork. Especially for boys ages 10 and older, with no girls around, there are fewer reasons to feel they must brag, tease, and bluster. In the absence of girls, boys don't feel as competitive or as vulnerable, and thus tend to be less tough on one another. They do less to shame their compatriots. All in all, they each tend to feel more self-confident and less dependent on a mask of bravado to cover their insecurities. In co-ed environments, by contrast, many boys fear that teachers or other students will ridicule them if they behave in certain ways that might not be seen as fully masculine. They may become anxious about discussing emotions evoked by a story or a poem, avoid answering teachers' questions so as not to look stupid by making a mistake or appearing effeminate by getting it right, and steer away from subjects thought of as feminine. When boys get to school, gender stereotypes are often vigorously enforced by students and teachers alike, and boys feel obligated to conform to them. This gender straitjacketing disrupts boys' educational experience. It leads them to overcompensate by being disruptive in the classroom, harassing other students, or intentionally acting dumb in courses like English and social studies, where showing even a scintilla of passion or intelligence may lead others to condemn them. To be fair, as these results from Hulse's study are based on observations at only two schools, they probably require further corroboration. But even if we cannot come to conclusions about the advantages of all-boys schools with scientific certainty, I believe this study provides compelling initial evidence that, at least for some boys, being at an all-boys school provides important benefits. Of course, the vast majority of boys, just as the vast majority of girls, will continue to receive their education in some type of coeducational environment. Our solution cannot and probably should not be to make all of our schools separate-sex schools, but I believe that we must try to apply the positive things we're learning about boys' schools to how boys are taught and treated in coeducational schools. For instance, just as some public schools have set up special girls-only programs in math and science, a kind of single-gender academy within the co-ed environment, I believe that similar experiments for boys, especially in areas of reading and writing, have tremendous promise. To cite one successful example of this concept, I should share the story of Jean Ellerby, a teacher in a co-ed public school, who serendipitously ended up teaching an all-boys English class. By chance, all the students in her high school freshman English class in one semester were boys. At first, it upset her, and she tried to force the school to dissolve it. But slowly she came to realize the unique possibilities it offered. While in her co-ed English classes, girls were more motivated and articulate, in the single-sex class, the boys appeared to her more at ease and not as embarrassed to speak up. The class, however, was looser and rowdier, something it took her a while to appreciate and value along with her boys. as one of the boys in her all-guy class commented to her, "Sometimes it can get a little rowdy with all guys, but it's easier for them to say what they want to say. If girls were there, you'd be scared of looking stupid." Indeed, as this comment reflects, even in a traditional co-ed school, boys placed in an all-male class that is empathic to boys' typical learning styles and tempos may feel freed to take off their armor and sound their authentic voices. Among the boys